Hi, hi, and welcome to episode 4 of Chachi Chats. This is a podcast where I get to talk to people I like about their bodies, bodies in general, and the complex lives which we lead. I'm Dani, and I've been running the Chachi Power Project since 2017. I explore the body positive movement, and this podcast series is all about sharing stories and learning together. This week, I get to talk to journalist, blogger, and fellow Scottish body positive advocate, Eli Kerr. We recorded this podcast a wee while ago, but in the wake of the new UK government anti-fat campaign, rehashing harmful messaging, amplifying that dangerous battle language, and employing dubious tactics to get the nation thinner, it seems very appropriate that I get to speak to Lai about her experiences of medical fat phobia and the long-lasting impact it has had on her life and body. Her story is really important, and she is really lovely. I hope you enjoy our chat. Here is Lai. Lai is a writer and blogger based in Glasgow. She's a staunch member and advocate of the body positive movement. And she may not quite agree because she's really humble, but I'm not going to let her argue. She's a passionate and eloquent speaker as well. I've heard her talk about anti-fat bias within medicine and how it has affected her personally. And I read her social posts about sex positivity, fat acceptance, chronic illness, and generally life. I'm really excited to have her in the chair so we can all hear her story. And we're going to chat around a few different things which might teach us all something we didn't know before. So hello, Lai. How are you doing?
I'm good.
Thanks for coming through from Glasgow.
No problem at all.
So we've followed each other for a while, and there's not that many people talking about this sort of thing within Scotland. So I find that like we show a lot of appreciation for each other.
Definitely.
It's really nice to like have someone else in this sort of space in Scotland championing the same sort of thing. So I'm really pleased to be your cheerleader.
Likewise.
So let's start with giving a bit of an explanation of who you are. And can you give me a little bit of a rundown of just what you do day to day and how you are working in this space?
Sure. So like you mentioned, I'm a writer and blogger and an activist. I am obviously involved in the fat positive, body positivity world. I also do work in reducing stigma within mental illness and chronic illness. I'm really passionate about how life-changing it can be to learn to accept your body and then hopefully move towards loving it and being happy in it. And I want other people to feel that. It makes me feel so sad when I hear people talking about the things they have to change before they can take the next step, or just how unhappy they feel in their own self.
So did you used to have body image issues?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay. And when did that like change for you?
Strangely enough, the kind of main catalyst was the first time I went to Australia. My brother lives in Australia, and I went to visit him, and I've got a niece over there as well, and they're in Brisbane, and it's like 35 degrees, and it just wasn't possible to do the usual covering up and like layers of I want to hide this bit, I want to hide that bit, and just like within the first week I found myself just thinking, well, I'll just have to wear this. And then very surprisingly I realised I don't actually hate how this looks. These things that I thought I could never wear, that or I need to hide my thighs, I need to hide my arms, I need to, obviously I've got scars as well, I just felt free and it felt so nice. I felt the sun on my skin. I was out playing with my niece and going swimming in water parks, and I wasn't worried about, are people staring at me? What do I look like? I've got a varicose vein, I've got stretch. I just didn't care. And yeah, that was the big turning point for me.
And roughly how old were you then?
I was 32, maybe 33.
Oh, so my life-changing moment came when I was 33. Must be something. I mean, we know that there's something about that age because every celeb dies at 33 or something, isn't there? The thing that Jesus lived till 33 or something.
Oh, yeah, Jesus was 33. So maybe I thought the celebs died at 27, but...
Oh, I'm gonna have to have a fact check.
Okay. Oh God, extra work on this podcast.
But yes, so there must be something about 33 for body image. Maybe that's just, maybe we need to like start that is the, don't worry, if you're 31, you'll get there at 33. Oh, I'm really pleased that you like came out the other side. And and then you started writing more about the subject after that point?
Yeah. I started to, I suppose, immerse myself in the community, because I came home feeling like there had been a big shift and really wanting to continue that and, I suppose, get deeper into it, because sometimes when you take yourself out of your life, things feel different, and then you come back to your life and it's so easy to just sink back into where you were. I started following lots of body positive blogs, social media, and then I just made changes. I stopped reading women's magazines. Mm-hmm. I stopped consuming TV and films and stuff that, as I was watching it, I was thinking, ooh, I don't like this, this is uncomfortable, or this is making me feel bad in any way. Mm-hmm. And then just started reading books and researching other options of how I could continue.
Yeah, I find that our culture is very strong and our ingrained behaviours are very strong.
Absolutely.
So if you have these sort of moments of enlightenment and moments of like changing your mindset about your body image, that's great. But wow, how amazing and how quick we are to fall back into previous modes of thinking.
Absolutely.
And it actually takes a lot of work, mm-hmm. and making sure that we're surrounding ourselves with the right messaging that to keep on that path.
Yeah. I don't think it's ever over. Like, you have to unlearn everything basically you've been taught since you were an infant. Mm-hmm. And then you have to keep working at it. Mm-hmm. Like, even this bodysuit I saw, not bodysuit, jumpsuit, I saw someone on Instagram wear it and I was like, oh, that's so cute, but I could never wear that. And then I tried to identify why I couldn't wear it, and I couldn't even pinpoint what part of my body or what it was that made me feel like I'm not good enough to have to wear it. And so then I thought, right, I'm going to buy it and I can always send it back. And then it came and I put it on and I was like, this is so cute, I love this. So it's like you have to constantly challenge yourself and constantly question
those thoughts. Yeah. I find myself still having to do that all the time, all the time. So the first time that I properly heard you speak was at an event organised by the Health and Social Care Alliance in Glasgow, mm-hmm. and it was about weight stigma within healthcare.
Yeah.
And why don't you tell me a little bit, like, who the Health and Social Care Alliance is, so that we understand what the event was about?
Sure. So they work as kind of an intermediary? Yes, for the third sector. They have three main goals. They want to make sure that actual service users are centred in decisions and policy making. They really strive to push for necessary change. And they also are kind of like cheerleaders and facilitators for different third sector organisations to like make partnerships. And they are really quite amazing. So they
try and drive policy change for health.
Within the health and social care sector in Scotland.
Right. Why don't we give the listeners a bit of a better understanding about what we mean by weight stigma, so it's a bit clearer what the event was and why you were speaking.
So, I mean, simply put, weight stigma is when medical professionals treat fat patients different than they would treat slimmer patients. And it's across the board. It's tiny little things to huge, massive, life-changing things.
Mm-hmm. And weight stigma doesn't necessarily just show up in the medical profession. Weight stigma affects all daily life.
Yeah.
From people being deprived from promotions at work,
or absolutely. The
way fat people are treated in society,
or
trolled, or, you know. Mm-hmm. But we are specifically going to talk about the way that weight stigma shows up in the healthcare industry and how it can impact people trying to access healthcare. Mm. And at the event, you were asked to speak and, like, honestly, everyone was in tears. Like, I was sobbing, and then everybody had a tear in their eye and a lump in their throat because they could see how much you had been impacted.
Yeah.
Can you tell us what you actually spoke about during the event?
Okay, so I'll kind of briefly cut it down.
You don't have to briefly. Like, honestly, it was the most emotive story ever.
So what happened was I started experiencing really severe kind of stomach and chest pains. And when I saw my GP, it was just straight off the bat, lose weight, change your diet. And at that time, I was still really immersed in diet culture. I was in like the middle of a crazy diet. I was eating like maybe 500 calories a day. I was trying to work off whatever calories I ate. But yeah, that was kind of encouraged. They were like, that's great, you're losing weight, fantastic. The pain just got worse. It went from kind of 20 minutes to hours to days. And it was like, I couldn't eat, I couldn't move, I couldn't sleep. I was going to A&E and just getting the same thing. Lose weight, change your diet. It's indigestion, it's heartburn, it's nothing serious. They would like give me a cup of Peptac, send me home.
And this pain was debilitating?
Oh, absolutely. Like, I was experiencing it for, it was over a year, and like, yeah, by the end it would last, I would get about and it would last for days, and I couldn't move. I couldn't, you can't lie down. So
when was this roughly?
I was about 30.
Okay.
When this happened. So yeah, about 2010. And like, I was caught between I'm losing my mind and I'm going to die. I knew that it wasn't, there's no way I could feel like this and not, there not be something wrong. I knew it wasn't heartburn. It just wasn't. Finally, the last time I went, I saw like a really awful doctor who kind of went between I was drug seeking or I was just basically an hysterical woman. yeah, he just dismissed me and sent me home. And all the times I'd been to A&E, it had always been that. It had been very patronising, very dismissive. You're making a big deal of something, or you're crazy, you're trying to get drugs, you're trying to... Nobody was ever very nice or kind, and no investigations or tests were ever done. I think once I had a chest x-ray, but that was kind of it. They just saw me, looked at me.
Like no blood tests or anything?
No. Saw me, looked at me, and were like, yeah, you're fat, that's the problem, basically. And even when I was kind of being honest with my doctor, saying, because I was losing lots of weight at the time, over that period I ended up losing 7 or 8 stone.
Wow.
And they just praised me. They were just like, that's great, keep losing weight, and like, what are you doing? And I was like, well, I'm basically not eating. Well, okay, that's good, get the weight off. And so,
my God.
Yeah, so when you're already stuck in that mindset and doctors are saying, well done, mm-hmm, great, good for you.
And you probably were getting praise from elsewhere.
Well, yeah,
as well.
I was getting so much, like I had really serious mental health issues at the time, and that was like the kind of one, I was getting all this positive feedback, you look amazing. And so that was, I was clinging to it in a way, because it was like, this is going to make me better, and this is the good thing in
and
my
people
life.
People are showing me love.
People,
because of
yeah,
it.
Everybody's really happy that I'm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you continue the behaviour.
Absolutely. So yeah, then that final time that I went to, like I say, just dismissed me, sent me home. He gave me a cup of Peptac and I threw it up immediately, like on the floor. And he just didn't care. I was just like discharge, off you go. And oh, so defeated that night. I went home and I was in so much pain and I could barely move and I was throwing up and I was scared because I knew definitely something was wrong, but it's like, what can I do? Nobody will listen to me. I go to A&E, nobody cares. And then just by luck, my mum had been in Glasgow that day and she dropped round. And when she saw the state of me, she was like really concerned. And she's like, right, we're going back. And then having someone else who's like fit and healthy and up for a fight, if you like, to advocate for me. Someone else saw me, a female doctor, which I think makes a difference. And she did the blood test, because that's all it was going to take to diagnose me, just a simple blood test. And by the time the blood results came back, that confirmed I had pancreatitis.
What's pancreatitis?
Pancreatitis is basically just inflammation of your pancreas. It's incredibly painful and it's very dangerous. Left untreated, it can be lethal.
Oh my God.
And so, yeah, basically that's what the kind of state I was in. By the time she'd got the blood test back, my organs were going into shock. My whole body was just shutting down. And I spent 7 days in HDU, which I don't even have no recollection. I was on a morphine drip. I was on fluids. I had a blood transfusion. I was just out of it, completely out of it. And then I was in hospital for like another 11 days after that on a ward. And yeah, the really, really infuriating part for me was I had classic symptoms. I was presenting with the absolute classic pancreatitis symptoms. I'm not the typical pancreatitis patient. It's usually middle-aged people, heavy drinkers, people who eat a lot of red meat. So obviously I didn't...
Oh, and you're a vegan.
Fit, yeah, I didn't fit that. But the actual pain that I was describing, the symptoms, the fact that I couldn't lie down, all the everything is classic pancreatitis. Mm. And yeah, I could have been diagnosed the first time I went to hospital if someone had just done that blood test.
My goodness.
Yeah.
What happened after that, that when you got out of hospital and you'd had the treatment, did you just have to deal with what you had experienced and recover?
Basically, yeah. So they, like, you, there isn't really a, like, a medication or anything for pancreatitis. They just have to, you can't eat, obviously, and they give you fluids and they have to monitor your input and your output and just keep you in hospital and watch you, basically. So once I was at a point where it was safe to go home, then I just had to wait for further tests to find out what the problem was and why it was happening. And eventually they took my gallbladder out, but I still had some bouts of pancreatitis after that. And it took years of seeing all sorts of people, but what eventually I kind of got to the bottom of was sometimes when your body goes through like a prolonged trauma like that, both emotionally and physically, it leaves an impact. It activates nerves and they start working in a way that they shouldn't. So you get pain that you shouldn't actually be feeling. And what I'm left with is fibromyalgia.
And is that connected? So that's connected
the pain specialists think that, yeah, usually what sets off fibromyalgia is a big traumatic experience. And the fact that mine was both physical and emotional and so prolonged, basically, yeah. They can't say for certain, obviously, but that's what it's been put down to. That's the most likely trigger.
And so how does fibromyalgia impact your life?
So fibromyalgia is, it's tough. It's basically widespread pain. So you can just hurt all over your body. It affects digestion in your stomach as well, headaches. You can't control your temperature probably. So if I get really cold, it's hard for me to then get hot. And if I get really hot, it's hard for me to cool down. And the really difficult part is that it's just changing all the time. So one day you think I feel reasonably okay, and the next day you could wake up and all your joints are agony. And then the next day you could wake up and it's something else, like your hands won't work proper. So that makes it very difficult, very unpredictable. You don't know how you're going to feel on any given day, what you might be able to do.
So this whole experience has had a massive impact,
yeah,
on your life. Mm-hmm. And fibromyalgia is chronic, right?
Yeah, there's no cure. There's no, you just have to live with it, basically.
So this is
manage
something
it
that you're going to have to deal with.
Yep.
So how, are you not raging?
Yes. It took me a while, actually, which is strange, because I was so engrossed in just not liking myself. And although I recognised that my body had impacted how people had treated me, I was still blaming myself, because I was like, well, if I wasn't such a big fatty, people would have listened to me. So rather than putting that on, well, they should have done their job, I was still putting that on me.
Right.
And then, yeah, it took a while, and I started to realise that this wasn't something that I'd caused, this was something that other people had done to me, in a way. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, I started to feel very angry. Even angrier when, years down the line again, through the pain specialists, I discovered that it was the dieting that probably caused my problem. Yo-yo dieting causes a lot of problems with your gallbladder and your pancreas. It's dangerous, it makes you ill. And so it had never been the fact that I had been overweight, it was the fact that I was constantly fighting against it.
Going up and down.
Yeah, so I spent my whole 20s, like, into my early 30s doing that dieting, losing tons of weight, obviously,
like,
put it.
So many other, like, not just women in society, but
yeah,
like, loads of people now. Uh-huh. Yeah, and I've read about how yo-yo dieting impacts your health.
Yep.
Way more than either being at a higher weight level or a lower weight level. It's actually the weight cycling that can be more
it's
damaging.
It's so hard on your body.
I've read, like, quite a lot of articles over the years about how this has impacted people and their interaction with the medical industry has actually caused them to potentially go undiagnosed for a long period of time, or there's lots of like fat phobia nearly killed my sister or did kill my sister or my baby affected babies, and you know, because do you know anyone personally that this has affected?
Yeah, I mean, obviously I know lots of stories through the like Bobo community, but I have two close friends who, it's funny you say about babies, who experience so much trouble both whilst trying to get pregnant and then whilst pregnant, just so much negativity, and like even whilst pregnant still being told to lose weight, being told straight off the bat you're a high risk pregnancy, this is really dangerous.
So what, how do they cope with that?
Yeah, I think it took a bit of the shine off their pregnancy a little bit, and the fact that a lot of time they would go to appointments and they knew it was going to be kind of negative and finger wagging. Mm-hmm. And also one of them in particular, it frightened her quite a lot, because when people keep telling you this, you start to worry, oh, is everything going to be okay? She was told she would definitely not be able to have a natural birth. She would have to have a cesarean. She was too big. She had a vaginal delivery and was absolutely, in fact, totally smooth, perfect delivery, no issue whatsoever. But yeah, lots of women I imagine will just take that on board and go, okay, I have to have a section. Yeah, it's worrying that like such a wonderful happy time
can be affected.
Yeah.
And you know, the thing is, doctors are incredible, nurses are incredible, like I thank heaven every day that we have a national health service that is free at the point of care. And doctors are stretched to the max, and GP appointments are like 10 minutes long, and you've got to get in a certain amount of information in that time. And, you know, we cannot shit on doctors.
No, and like, even from my bad experiences, I've had lots of bad experiences, but for every bad experience or every unpleasant doctor or nurse, I've equally met and been treated by wonderful doctors, you know, that it does, it balances out in that sense, that I'm definitely not saying all medical professionals are awful.
But the truth is, we live in a very fat-phobic culture. Mm-hmm. You know, we have weight stigma around us all the time that impacts us as individuals every day. That's why we, you know, even people who are fat have internalized this message and hate themselves and hate other fat people, even though they are living
sometimes
that experience.
Even more than slimmer people.
Yeah. So we also have to remember that doctors and nurses and GPs and medical professionals are living in that culture also. Doctors are not immune from living in the culture that we live in. There's actually research that's done, and I've got information. There's a study, impact of weight bias and stigma on quality of care and outcomes for patients with obesity, by S.M. Fellin, D.J. Burgess and M. Van Ryn. And the whole outcome of the research is, many healthcare providers hold strong negative attitudes and stereotypes about people with obesity. There is considerable evidence that such attitudes influence person perceptions, judgment, interpersonal behavior, and decision making. These attitudes may impact the care they provide. Experiences of or expectations for poor treatment may cause stress and avoidance of care, mistrust of doctors, and poor adherence among patients with obesity. Stigma can reduce the quality of care for patients with obesity, despite the best intentions of healthcare providers to provide high quality care. Like, we know that nurses and doctors are trying their best to provide a certain level of care at all times. It just so happens that bias sometimes comes into their treatment.
Yep. I think also it's important to note that the way that doctors and nurses are educated is in a sense very fat phobic. They are still taught that it's bad to be fat, that it's really unhealthy to be fat. And so in a sense, they are just doing what they were trained to do.
When a patient presents who is in a larger body, a lot of the time the first thing that will be prescribed is weight loss.
Yep.
And weight loss specifically and only.
Yes.
And weight loss, obviously a doctor will prescribe it in a, we want you to do it in the healthiest way possible and like this, but there's an urgency to sometimes a diagnosis, and obviously there's very little help that can be given in a 10 minute GP appointment. Mm-hmm. And also it's been shown that the amount of nutritional information that doctors are given during their education is so minimal,
yeah,
because the focus, you know, there's so much pressure, yeah, to cover other areas of the curriculum, mm-hmm, that mean that the ability to know what is best health-wise, mm-hmm, for a patient when it's to do with nutritional intake is not massive.
Yeah.
So I wanted to read, I was just reading this book that was hilarious, This Is Going to Hurt by Adam Kay, Secret Diary of a Junior Doctor. And I mean, the book is hilarious. The amount of stories that come from it are just like, I was laughing out loud. It is slightly fatphobic at times, but I wanted to read one particular paragraph which really struck me, because it says, among all of the predictably hilarious remarks the patient made to me, one said something surprisingly astute. It's funny. You don't think of doctors getting ill. It's true, and I think it's part of something bigger. Patients don't actually think of doctors as being human. It's why they're so quick to complain if we make a mistake or if we get cross. It's why they'll bite our heads off when we finally call them into our overrunning clinic's room at 7 p.m, not thinking that we also have homes we'd rather be at. But it's the flip side of not wanting your doctor to be fallible, capable of getting your diagnosis wrong. They don't want to think of medicine as a subject that anyone on the planet can learn. And it's true, because yeah, I used to think about this as well. Doctors are the word of God,
mm-hmm,
to a lot of people, majority of people.
Yeah.
And, you know, what they say goes. But we have to remember that doctors are also living in this society.
Definitely.
And you get to have a say in your medical treatment.
Yes.
And you get to speak up if you don't agree, or you want to ask further questions, yeah, or you want to clarify why they're diagnosing, mm-hmm, a certain method. You get to have that say.
Yep.
And that is something that is really important in this discussion,
yeah,
that we want to make sure that people feel more empowered when they are receiving healthcare.
Yeah. And it can be difficult, as I've experienced myself, to question a doctor, because you're not a doctor and you're aware of that. And so you're like, do I have the right to debate with this expert, if you like? And something that I have found really helpful is to start with just saying, how would you approach this, or what would you suggest if I were a thin patient? Because it's not that confrontational, it's just asking a question, and then it does actually make that doctor think, oh, well, would I be doing something different, and therefore, is there other things I should be doing here?
Okay. That is pretty, I hate the term, ballsy. A lot of people would feel uncomfortable saying something like that, but I think it's really important to recognise, yeah, that, like, that is true. You deserve the best healthcare, mm-hmm, and making a health practitioner recognise where, yeah, they may be, uh-huh, treating you slightly different to other people.
Yeah.
What are the things that you think need to be done about this? Do you think it's about re-education? Do you think,
yeah,
it's about limiting what is allowed to be discussed by doctors, or the language that they could be using, or the practices that they do as part of healthcare?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of, yeah, all of that you said. Basically, we do need to change the way doctors are educated on this area. There's so much research about just the fact that diets don't work, that it's not really safe to recommend dieting, and yet it's still the first line. And there's so much research now also on the fact that fat does not necessarily mean unhealthy. People can be fat and live long, happy, healthy, active lives. So yeah, I think we need to re-educate existing, and change the way we educate new people coming through. But yeah, there is an element of, there should be some things that are off limits. I feel uncomfortable saying doctors should never talk about weight, or, because again, I'm not a doctor, and I don't think you should limit the expert. I don't know for absolute certain that there aren't conditions that some weight loss would be, you know, I can't say that because I'm not a professional. I definitely think the way it's talked about and the way it's dealt with needs to change,
mm-hmm,
and we need to put limits on the pressure for weight loss, as opposed to recommending lifestyle changes.
Yeah,
yeah.
Which is something that the Health at Every Size movement talks, mm-hmm, about. Like, Health at Every Size doesn't automatically assume that you are healthy automatically at every size,
yeah,
or that weight loss, it might not be part of your, mm-hmm, Pam, but it's about encouraging healthy behaviours.
Absolutely.
Rather than just prescribing weight loss.
Yeah. And also changing or in trying to change the way people think about lifestyle changes. It doesn't have to be I have to go to the gym and get on a diet because I must lose weight. It should be more about, let's try and find something that you enjoy doing that can get you active, that is pleasurable and that makes you feel better. Let's talk about what foods do you like or what do you not know about? Do you need to know about cooking skills? Are you unsure which ingredients are good for, you know, provide you which nutrients like that so yeah. that people are...
And what are the other barriers that you may have in your life yeah. that help you access like wellness and yeah. well-being and what does that actually look like for you?
So that it's about enhancing a person's life regardless of if that results in weight loss or weight gain or just let you live a full, happy, active life to, you know, as best you can. Mm-hmm.
There's one other specific bugbear that I know that you have within diet culture, don't you?
Yes.
What is that?
I have become very annoyed with this new trend of diet culture co-opting the body positive movement. I've noticed recently on Instagram in particular, you'll see ads which use all the body positive like hashtags. So it'll be like fat posy, body positive, self-love, visibly fat, all that stuff. And it's an ad for a diet, it's an ad for a personal trainer, it's an ad for you can lose 12 pounds in 3 weeks. And it really winds me up because it is targeting people that you know are trying to opt out of that mm-hmm. and trying to drag them back in because there's no other reason to put those tags on it. Mm-hmm. You know that people are following those tags don't want to be part of diet culture. Mm-hmm.
Some of those products, they label themselves as wellness or lifestyle change, but really what's driving it is weight loss mm-hmm. and being a smaller size.
Absolutely.
Because they know that that is what a lot of people are driven mm-hmm. to achieve.
Yeah.
But they're kind of moving into those areas so that they can surreptitiously...
Yep.
get in amongst it and yeah. feed you the message in a different way. And a lot of them disguise it as like weight loss for self-love.
Yeah. Or like learn to love yourself by doing this diet.
By controlling what you eat.
Yes. Or things like Noom. Mm. So it's not a diet. That's their whole advertising. It's not a diet. It's a new experience. It's teaching you about, it's a diet.
Is Noom the one where they give you deliver food or what?
Noom is like, it's an app that you pay monthly for. What they say is it like analyzes your behavior, like when you eat, why you eat, which I suppose could be helpful to some people, but the ultimate goal of it is to lose weight and for them to say, so you say today I had breakfast, I had toast, and then at 11 o'clock I felt stressed and I had a chocolate biscuit and a cup of tea. And their feedback would be, you shouldn't stress eat, go and take a deep breath or whatever. So it's just the same old stuff, mm-hmm. but repackaged in a, we're looking out for your, it's like in a holistic approach. And
right, let's not advertise more for them.
Sorry.
So who are the biggest culprits that you see sort of perpetuating this? I know it's brands, but like, do you see influencers doing it?
Oh yeah, things? Yes. I mean, it's big, like Instagram is a big hub for that kind of thing. So you've got like all your reality TV stars who even recently were caught up in a BBC investigative journalist who offered them a lot of money to promote this product, which the main ingredient of it was cyanide. But they offered it as a weight loss.
Cyanide? Are you
well,
sure?
Yeah, it's not a real, no, it's not a real product.
Oh.
So it's like a fake. Oh, yeah, that's not.
I was like, seriously, do you mean caffeine? Or
no,
what do you
no,
mean?
No, nobody's actually selling cyanide. It was
they set them up.
Yeah,
oh, right,
so they offered it. And they tell them, like, as they're speaking to them, the main ingredient is cyanide. It's great for weight loss. If you don't actually want to use it, it's fine, but we'll pay you whatever to say
that you've used it.
And they agree. They're like, yeah, that's fine. I mean, I've done stuff before that I haven't actually used. None of them actually go, obviously none of them immediately recognise cyanide is lethal. But nobody thought, oh, well, let me speak to someone and check out what this product is before
and
I agree.
What are the tests that have been done?
Nothing,
where's the research?
Just, yeah, that's fine. We'll do that.
How much are you going to pay me?
Yes.
Yeah. And what can people do to protect themselves from all of that? Like being able to recognize it, but also not taking part in diet culture and not taking part in this sort of co-opted body positivity section of the body positive movement as a whole.
I think the basics, the first steps are just being careful with what you consume. So view it with a critical eye. If something is claiming to be about wellness or lifestyle, if it involves restriction, if it involves counting calories, if it involves foods that aren't okay to eat, if it involves...
the focus being weight loss.
If it involves fasting, that's a diet and no.
And the thing is that we want to remind people is like they get to choose what they do with their body.
Absolutely, yeah.
If people want to lose weight, they can lose weight if they want to.
Yeah, this advice is aimed at people who want to opt out.
But diet culture is about weight loss being the ultimate goal and it being more important than the person's sanity, than the person's health, mental, physical well-being.
Yeah.
And that is what is so anger-inducing about diet culture is beyond anybody else's, you know, well-being, it's about them being smaller and being a lower weight despite everything else.
Yeah.
So that is the anger-inducing and the unhelpful part of diet culture.
And the fact as well that it is driven by money. These influencers, these company, they don't care about you. They're not wanting to make your life better or make you happy. It's a huge money-making industry.
Mm-hmm.
And that's their focus. Mm-hmm. We need to continue to make people think that thinner is better, that if you're slimmer, your life will be better. You'll have to get your weight down because then people will keep buying these products.
Yeah, one of my most liked posts on Instagram is the diet industry does not care about you.
Yeah.
And we just have to remember that. So when you continually buy into it, it does not look out for your well-being.
No.
And you need to look out for your well-being because nobody else is.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's what I find so frustrating about this back alley disguising yourself is it's like we said, body positivity is a continuous learning process and you have to keep reminding yourself of certain facts and keep pushing yourself. And so if someone's trying to do that and is on that journey and these people are like sneaking in and I hate that because it's a person who's vulnerable that has a weakness for that kind of thing and you're trying to get in there and profit from it
and
rather than letting them be happy and live their life.
All they're trying to do is improve their relationship to their body. They found this movement that's really helpful, that's helping them figure out their relationship to food, the relationship to body, how we treat other bodies in society, and then insidiously this little weedly brand diet brand is coming in and co-opting the movement and is distracting them. It's just so infuriating for people. And so I agree, like being critical about who you're following, about the messages that are even within the movement.
Yeah.
Making sure like there are specific people that if you are part of the body positive movement, you will come across this certain specific people that you will learn to know that you can trust. They are saying they are very well aware of these brands that are and they are very critical.
Mm-hmm.
And I definitely know that there's certain people. And what we'll do is in the show notes, I'll link to a few people that I definitely trust, that I recommend that other people follow, so that you can have a bit of a better head start. And I mean, we're not going to badmouth other people and say not to follow. But I think definitely if you educate yourself just a little bit, you will start to recognize it more and more.
Yeah.
And another factor that you have concern about is children being exposed to diet culture. And I also am very particular about this specific focus. And I have seen conversations take place with my own eyes about body hatred, about fasting, about exercise equating to calories burnt in front of children. What are your specific concerns here?
I mean, I suppose just the fact of how vulnerable children are to messaging, especially from people they love and respect. Whether that be a friend, a teacher, a family member, or a celebrity, that when you're young, these people are a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
Pop stars, TV, people that you love and look up to. If you're getting that messaging from them, they soak it up.
Yeah, like we are with doctors and the word of God.
Yes.
Like kids are with just like adults that they respect.
Yes, absolutely.
They can do no wrong. And
well, yeah, and they believe it, especially like your teachers and your mum or whatever. That's like an authority figure, but it's also something that you trust. Mm-hmm. So you believe what those people tell you.
And so their behaviour is something that you will absolutely soak up and yes. start mimicking. And
definitely, yeah. So I think that's a mistake that a lot of people make, although they are conscious of never directly giving those messages to their children. They won't see you have to lose weight or you can't eat that's bad or whatever, but they do behave that way. They are on a diet, or they are, oh, I shouldn't really have this, and
yeah, this is bad.
Yeah, some foods are good and some foods are bad, or you have yeah. to earn a treat. And kids see their mum, and they soak that up as well. Yeah,
so it's not necessarily about what is being said to children, it's about the behaviour and the actions yeah. that are being displayed around children mm-hmm. that we have to be conscious of.
Yeah.
And we're so used to it, and a lot of people don't even notice it because it's everywhere.
Yeah.
And because we've been working and advocating in this movement for a while, we know exactly what diet culture can look like, even in its more subtler forms. Like, I don't know about you, but like when I hear it happen around me, it's like a little electric shock.
Yes.
And I'm like, oh, I don't hear that very often anymore. And so what are some of the smaller ways that diet culture tends to show up specifically around kids that it might be helpful for listeners to notice more or be more aware of?
So like I was saying, talking about your own weight or your own body negatively, they hear that and they pick that up, and then they start reflecting that onto themselves. Mm-hmm. I think also giving food a moral value. Something's good, something's bad. You can have that as a treat because you did such and such. Mm-hmm. We were at the park all afternoon running around, therefore you can have a slice of cake mm-hmm. because...
reward behaviour.
Yes, because then the message you're giving to them is you have to earn this thing.
And one of the things that I really notice and hate is the passing judgment on other people's bodies.
Yes.
So you just got really angry there. So like watching TV mm-hmm. and pointing out things about people's bodies or inferring something because someone has a certain body type. That really irks me.
Yes.
Because you don't, like, it's so, we live in such a patriarchal society mm-hmm. that it's just so commonplace yeah. to, like, point out differences yeah. in people.
And, yeah, I think people do it without thinking or without considering the impact it has on either fat people around them or, yeah, children or little ears that are listening.
Mm-hmm. And it's not even just about fat people either. It's about people with disabilities yeah. and disfigurements. Uh-huh.
Yeah,
and,
absolutely. Yes,
or even blonde hair or dark hair.
Yes, it's so common. And yeah, it affects the whole society mm-hmm. because it reinforces all those messages, and it's so casual as well, mm-hmm. which I think in some ways is more dangerous.
It's really hard to stop yourself from doing if you're in the way of being critical. Mm-hmm. Generally, you kind of have to stop yourself and recognise, you know, what that's actually contributing to yeah. the culture around us, to the people mm. around us that are hearing that. Mm. One thing that I want to talk about is a paragraph that I saw you had written for Bust magazine. And I'm just going to quote you.
Okay.
I will quote you back to you. I will never understand why people think it is okay to express the revulsion of fat people to me, a fat person. If you had brown hair and I repeatedly made negative comments about brown hair, you'd probably feel hurt or pissed off. Well, surprise, surprise, fat people have feelings too.
Yes. It took me a long time to be able to vocalise that, to actually be able to say to people, point out what they'd just done. So like you say, you're watching a movie, and I remember one time watching a movie and it opened on, it was like a mortuary kind of thing, and it was like a fat male body on a mortuary slab mm-hmm. and the friend I was with was like, oh, nobody wants to see that. And that was the first time that I thought, well, I'm gonna say something. And when we came out, I was like, what you were saying there was, nobody wants to see a body like mine. Oh, no, that's absolutely not what I was saying. You're gorgeous, you're fine. And I'm like, no, when you say that, I know what you really think about fat bodies.
Mm-hmm. Good for you for speaking
well. But it's hard. There's still lots of times where things like that are said and I don't in yeah. the moment speak up. But I have noticed a shift in some of my closer friends. that I can see them starting to say something and stop. Mm-hmm. Or I have noticed some friends who, when they diet, just don't mention it in front of me. So like, we'll be out somewhere and they'll just order a soup, but whereas they would be like, oh, I'm trying to be good today, or I'm going out for dinner tomorrow night, they just don't mention it. They just order their soup, they do their life, I do mine. Mm-hmm. Which is the impact of that is
massive. And when you think about it, if people just dial down their weight talk or their, I mean, obviously if you're going through stuff, talk to people. That's that is number one messaging of people suffering from body image issues or mental health problems. Reach out and talk to people. But your relationship with your body, and if you want to make your body smaller for physical attractive reasons that you ascribe to, or if you are making choices for your body, it doesn't necessarily mean that you need to share that.
That's it. Yeah, I am passionate about this topic and about reaching people that it will benefit, that want to hear this, that want to be able to live a life where they're happy as they are. You would not say to someone with dark hair is ugly, or I hate my hair, I need to change it, I can't live like this, it's making me miserable. So why is it okay to talk about bodies like that, weight like that?
And why is it?
I think just because society is so entrenched in it. I think most of the time, no damage is meant. Nobody's trying to hurt you. Those people probably don't really think that badly of you personally. But it's just so accepted. In the same way that diet talk is just accepted as small talk, whereas...
body hatred is accepted as small talk.
Yeah, I don't think that's a healthy or reasonable thing to talk about with a work colleague or a person you don't really know very well, or even a person you do know very well, unless you know they want to engage in that.
Yeah.
But it's just accepted as the weather, how was your day?
Let's bond over this.
We bond over how much we dislike ourselves.
Yeah.
Which is crazy.
Oh, it's just so enraging when you think about it. It's like, what could we be doing?
Mm-hmm.
How could we be bonding?
Yeah.
How could we be seeing similarities in ourselves and the people around us? And yet this is what we've chosen to do. But this is, it's not what we've chosen, it's what we've been taught to do.
That is it. We have been taught this all our lives, and I think people think that that's an overstatement, or that you're getting into conspiracy theory territory or whatever, but it's really not. This has surrounded certainly myself, and you're of a similar age to me, your whole life. This is the messaging that you have always got.
It's something that's struck me as really simple. It's like, we are generally empathetic people, we recognize our actions, and yet this is something that happens all the time, and we don't recognize it. We need to start.
How
can people like follow what you do?
So the blog is Something in the Way She Moves. I am Wee Frumpy on social media, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
WEE_FRUMPY. You've done that before.
Yes. And then, if you find me on there, you'll be able to link to all sorts of other things that I've done as well.
Yeah, there's loads of links to articles that you've written from your blog. I just want to say thank you very much for coming through. I really appreciate talking to you and hearing your story and sharing with us.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure. I've loved it.
I really recommend you give Lai a follow. And there's also a link in the show notes to a site where you can buy her a well-deserved coffee. I want to thank her for being my guest on Chatty Chats, and I want to thank you for listening. If you've missed any of my previous episodes, then this may be a good chance to catch up, as I've had some really great conversations with some awesome people. If you have a story you'd like to share, if you fancy sponsoring the podcast, or you want to ask a question, then send me an email to danny@chatchypowerproject.co.uk. Thanks to everyone who's left a review, and I always welcome feedback, so don't be shy. This week, little Freddie took his line memorising very seriously, and it sure paid off. If your wee one wants to contribute to Chatty Chats, then send me a message and we'll work something out. So, goodbye from me, and hey Freddie, what do you want to tell everyone?
Thanks for tuning in. Remember to like and subscribe. Goodbye, have a good day.